Everyone, I'd like to call to order this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee on Thursday, February 8th, 2007, here in the Belt Room of the State Capitol. We're joined today by Senator Bundy, Senator Davis, Senator Stevens, and myself, Senator Ellis. Thank you all for being with us today. The first order of business is Senate Bill 59, further consideration of the bill relating to broadcasting promoting charitable gaming. And we continued the public hearing from the last committee session, and I will ask if there's any further public testimony, anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 59. We do have a Mr. Bob Kern and a Mr. Stuart White of KTN, KFMJ Radio, to testify. Would those folks come forward? Or no, these are folks online. Mr. Kern, are you there?
Yes, I am. I let Stuart take the first shot.
Okay, let's have Mr. White come forward then.
Okay, hello. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, please restate your name and affiliation for the record, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Okay. I'm Stuart White with KFMJ Radio in Ketchikan, Alaska. And I have a bit of a prepared statement that I put here. There has been some argument that passage of the last year's bills and also this year's bill, Senate Bill 59, and the similar bill in the House could lead the way to more legalized gambling in Alaska. And this is something that's far from the truth. Senate Bill 59 will enable over-the-air broadcasters to advertise activities that are already legal. It does not seek to further the cause of those intent on making any other forms of gambling legal in the state. Do not let this false argument confuse our facts. Alaska Statute 5-15-640A bans radio and television stations from advertising lawful charitable gaming or conduct, while newspapers are not banned. It may well deny broadcasters equal protection under federal and state constitutions, since the act prohibits, without rational basis, the broadcast media from engaging in conduct that is allowed by print media. Senate Bill 59 is legislation that should have happened years ago to fix problems associated with Alaska Statute 5-15-640, problems that have plagued all of Alaska's broadcasters, public and private, urban and rural radio and television. SB 59 will allow for a level playing field for Alaska's broadcasters. Currently, Alaska broadcasters are prohibited from airing ads regarding charitable gaming activity, such as raffles and lotteries. Newspapers are able to run these. This not only causes an unfair situation, it's also very confusing to many of the potential advertisers who do not know about this discrepancy. Radio and television staffs and their management are left to try and explain the validity of this statute that they often don't fully understand. Many potential advertisers come away from this exchange feeling misled, bamboozled, or lied to, and the disgruntled advertiser then speaks their mind to virtually anyone who will listen, and they cast the station or whomever it is in a poor light. And especially in small towns, word tends to travel very, very quickly, and we're left to suffer from repercussions of upholding the law. And this scenario played out a few years specifically with us when we had a group that came in wanting to advertise one of their annual raffles. It was actually the First City Rotary wanting to advertise their rubber duck races, and we had to tell them that we could not do this, even though they were able to in the paper. And this individual also, along with being in Rotary, has many ties to other nonprofits in the community and was casting everything in a bad light, even though our manager, our production director, and our sales manager all told her we were just trying to stay above board. Many well-meaning people trying to raise needed money for their nonprofits are generally disappointed but understanding when we explain why we can't talk about their raffles and other games of chance. They have many other means for fundraising, like spaghetti feeds, candy sales, auctions. Those are things we can talk about, but for some of them, the raffle is the biggest or the only fundraising event that they have every year, and it has been estimated by some that if they were allowed to use radio or television, that their sales of tickets might triple. And for a community-based nonprofit organization operating on a shoestring, this can be the difference between growth and attrition or success and failure. And we in broadcasting believe strongly in the power and reach of our media to not be able to use these traits to the betterment of nonprofits in our community. Nonprofits that add to the color, fabric, and quality of life in our communities is nearly unconscionable. The mandate put forth... Sorry?
No, go ahead.
Okay. The mandate put forth to us by the FCC is that we operate in the public interest. Not coming to the aid of this facet of the public is in direct opposition to this mandate. And along with First City Rotary, there are also other organizations in town that we have had dealings with in the past few years that I know personally or my coworkers have worked with, in like the Chamber of Commerce, who annually does their Enchanted Forest Auction and Dance, which is their main one fundraiser. And there is many facets of it that we can advertise for them. The one, of course, that we can't being their big raffle that they always do. And so far, I think there's only been 1 year out of the years that they've been doing this fundraiser that they've actually made it into the black. Most years they've still remained into the red. Then also there's a group, Alaskan Cebucon, who does fundraising for their travel. They did a raffle a few years back and have been kind of unable to get anything going on that again due to not the inability to use the media and not having the money to pay the paper prices. And that's pretty much everything I had, and I'll pass on to Bob.
Mr. White, thank you very much. I'd like the record to reflect that Senator Hoffman has joined the committee. Are there questions or comments for Mr. White? Senator Bundy?
Yeah, thank you. I guess I hear, maybe it's a semantic discussion, but you said very strongly that this bill wouldn't expand gambling, and I suppose it depends on what you call expansion, but then you also said that people could just advertise on the radio, and I believe radio advertisement is effective, otherwise you wouldn't be able to sell it. They would have three or four times the customers for their lottery or whatever it is that they're doing. So while it may not increase new kinds of gambling, surely it will encourage more people to be involved in gambling than beforehand. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any sense advertising on the radio, would there?
Right, but the distinction does need to be made that these nonprofit organizations and the like that already have the legal right to present these games, and and the fact that they would either survive or go away is kind of the important crux of it there. And increased ticket sales for the group who provides a lot of services in the community, a group like the Rainy Day Quilters, who does a lot of charitable things, giving to families in need and the like, for them to continue what they want to do and to continue to help the community, I see that as a positive side to that. And when we're talking about not bringing in new types of gambling, I mean, we're talking about larger groups. We're talking about like riverboats, and we're talking like Bally's is not going to come up here just if we pass this little law to allow these organizations who have already advertised in newspapers to also be able to advertise on the radio and television.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I understand all that, and these charitable people could probably even make more money if they had card rooms. And I wouldn't fault them for wanting to do that. I just find your argument that it won't expand gambling inaccurate, in that it'll have more people participate, which is the goal. And so, in at least in one view, that is an expansion. That's not a negative. It's just trying to make the record accurate, I think.
Thank you, Senator Bundy. Mr. White, thank you very much. Could we have Mr. Kern come forward? And I do want to say for Mr. Kern and Ms. Slaniker, who will be next, that we do hope to get to consideration of the bill for moving it along from this committee. But we do want to have a full public hearing. So, Mr. Kern, could you please come forward?
Yes, so thank you for allowing me to testify before the committee this afternoon. My name is Bob Kern. I'm the president of TLP Communications here in Ketchikan. We operate and own KFMJ Radio, and we also own and operate and publish the local paper here in Ketchikan. And basically, I'd like to say ditto to virtually everything that Mr. White had to say, and also expand on his comments a little bit. The other day, and I'd like to address specifically the huge confusion that there is among Alaska broadcasters between what the federal government allows and what the state government allows, and how it's affecting local radio and TV stations. For instance, I was watching KUBD television just the other night. That's the CBS station here in Ketchikan. And a PSA came on the air announcing a Friends of the Library raffle here in Ketchikan. And I was sitting there, I practically choked on my root beer, knowing that the raffle and gaming announcements are not allowed here in the state. Anyway, the station's programming is fed to a satellite out of Denver, and it is simulcast by TV stations here in Ketchikan and also in Juneau and Sitka. Anyway, I called them up yesterday morning and told them that it was illegal to run those raffle spots in Alaska. And the person I talked to, the manager of the station, incidentally, she said, well, golly, we didn't know that. She said, I thought that was only for radio and not TV. Anyway, they said they would take the spots off the air immediately. And if nothing else, I think the legislature should pass this legislation to protect station owners and employees from being fined or having their licenses threatened by the actions of employees or others who are confused by all the conflicting regulations that they have to deal with. What was legal for them to broadcast and upload in Denver and 48 of the other 50 states was against the law to broadcast in Alaska. And I might sit here and say, why? It just seems absolutely crazy to me. See, also, I was listening the other day and also last year when this legislation came up, and I forgot who brought the subject up, one of the senators, I believe, who thought that gaming spots could be allowed to be broadcast in the state, but only as free public service announcements. Fact is, most of our daytime airtime is sold out, and any free PSAs get relegated to the time period between midnight and 5 a.m. And as a matter of fact, a lot of them would get bumped by baldness commercials and diet commercials, and frankly would do these nonprofit organizations very little good at all. And I also, in addition to that, think that it is a little out of the way to expect broadcasters to give away our limited spot inventory by providing free PSAs. Newspapers don't give away their space, and I don't think radio stations should be allowed to do so or required to do so either. Fact is, my own newspaper doesn't give away any space. Another problem area is self-conducted lotteries. Non-commercial KRBD here in Ketchikan conducted a fundraising boat giveaway raffle for several years, and I heard someone turned them into the Gaming Commission a couple of years ago, and if I heard correctly, they wouldn't be able to self-conduct any fundraising raffles for their stations either if legislation is not corrected. Say, I believe last year broadcasting in the Internet was also brought up as part of the of this proposal, or at least somebody had brought it up, and I might add that broadcasting and the Internet are already deeply intertwined, and just the act of putting up a web page that's open to anybody who clicked on it is broadcasting. Many stations, including KFMJ, are also streaming their audio on the Internet, so we need to be careful to include the Internet in any definition of broadcasting. And I was looking at Senate Bill 59, and also in Section 515, and I noticed that broadcasting, radio and television broadcasting, is not defined at all. Although Senate Bill 59 says in this subsection, broadcasting includes television and radio transmission by 2,500 megahertz. I don't know anybody that broadcasts on 2,500 megahertz. Microwave video and audio programming, I don't know of anybody who broadcasts on microwave. Microwave is a point-to-point communication system. Slow-scan television programming has not been used for years by anyone, except other than maybe amateur operators. And it also talks by programming by way of satellite, cable, teletype, which nobody uses anymore, facsimile transmission, and other distribution methods. And I guess I might either ask that you strike that entire section in this subsection, broadcasting includes, et cetera, et cetera, or add digital distribution methods, since so many stations are transmitting in a digital mode now, which is not exactly the traditional definition of broadcasting. And one more thing.
Mr. Kern, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up your comments, if you could. We appreciate your suggestions, and did you have one more thought?
Yes, I had one more thought, and it also deals with the discrepancy and the confusion that arises between state and federal regulations. The station here in Ketchikan was reported to the FCC for broadcasting lottery information and promoting it quite heavily, I might add, on their radio station last year. And somebody turned them into the FCC, and the FCC came out with this particular a judgment on their use of broadcasting raffles. It said, although 18 U.S.C. 1304 prohibits the broadcast of information concerning a lottery, 18 U.S.C. 1307A2A states that the provision of Section 1304 shall not apply to an advertisement concerning a lottery that is authorized or otherwise not prohibited by the state in which it is conducted and which is conducted by a not-for-profit organization. The information before us indicates that the ADA, that's the American Diabetes Association, is a not-for-profit organization, that it conducted the event and raffle as fundraisers, and that the state of Alaska had given the ADA a charitable gaming permit for the period covered by the event. Thus, the FCC says, it appears that the stations did not violate 18 U.S.C. 1304 or the related commission rule, in as much as their provisions specifically are not applicable to advertisements about events which are conducted by the American Diabetes Association. Therefore, we close this matter. In other words, they decided not to prosecute or fine the radio stations here in the state because you guys with the state of Alaska gave them a permit, the ADA, to operate and conduct their raffle, and there's just an absolutely huge divide between what you folks have in your regulations and what the FCC decides that they're going to prosecute. As a matter of fact, I learned that the State Gaming Commission only gave the radio station a call and said, you probably shouldn't do this anymore. And there were no consequences, basically. So, anyway, that's all I had to say.
Thank you, Mr. Kern.
But thank you very much for allowing me to do so.
Okay. Julie Slaniker. Ms. Slaniker, yes. Could you come forward, please, and we'll, you know, try and be as quick as you can with your comments, and then we're going to set this bill aside for a few minutes. Please go ahead. If you could state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is Julie Slaniker, and I am here representing the Rainy Day Quilt Guild and also Ketchikan Little League Baseball. I have been a fundraising officer for both of those nonprofit organizations for the last 2 to 3 years. And one thing that we have, both organizations have noticed, is that it is more difficult than ever to raise funds for the things that, expenses that both of the groups have. In the case of the Rainy Day Quilt Guild, we have two raffles that we do every year. One for the Blueberry Arts Festival raffle quilt, and one every year in February for the our annual Quilting in the Rain quilt show. Both raffles do fairly well for us, but would do significantly better if we were able to advertise on the radio. We have noticed in the past that when we are able to advertise our monthly meetings and our actual quilt show itself on the radio, we get about 10 times the response from our radio ads than we do from our paper ads. So for us as a charitable organization to continue to do the things that we do, one of our founding charters is community service, and we do a lot of donated projects. Fabric costs a lot of money these days, and so for us to continue, we need to have those fundraisers to where then we can purchase fabric and batting and quilting paraphernalia in order to continue to provide fire quilts to people who are burned out in their homes here in town. Also, bibs that we make for the residents of the Pioneer Home and the Senior Home, and baby quilts to babies that are born at the hospital that are maybe in medical crisis. So those things, we found that we really would like to continue all of those programs, and for us to be able to raise more funds with our fundraising raffles would really help towards that end. As far as Little League Baseball is concerned, Little League has enacted strict rules nationwide regarding how much and what fundraising we can do, and also the percentage of participation from each Little League player and family. So we are limited as to what we can have the kids do. One of the only things that we can still have parents and kids participate in is the sale of raffle tickets. Unfortunately, in Ketchikan, every single organization, charitable organization, has raffle tickets at different times of the year. Well, the more people that you can get to know about your raffle, of course, the more tickets that you can sell. It costs a ton of money, unfortunately, for us to advertise in the paper venue. A single ad that runs one day, which is 2 by 4 inches, runs about $80, and that's with a nonprofit rate. For that same $80, we could go to KFMJ and use their nonprofit rate and receive a week's worth of advertising that would definitely promote our raffle in a much more efficient manner. So on behalf of both organizations, the Rainy Day Quilt Guild and Ketchikan Little League, we urge you to level the playing field for these nonprofit organizations and pass this legislation so that we can continue to fundraise and provide for the communities that we are active in activities for our youth. And I will close my comments with that. Thank you very much for listening.
Ms. Lanica,
have a great day.
Thank you for being with us today. We appreciate the good work you do in the community and your testimony today. Are there any comments or questions for Ms. Lanica? If not, is there anyone else here in Juneau who would like to testify? If not, or online, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on the legislation. We're going to set it aside for a few moments. I think the sponsor wants to think about a couple of things here, and we will come back to that bill before the end of today's meeting. Let's move on now to Senate Bill number 68, relating to motor vehicle insurance. The prime sponsor is Senator Hollis French. Senator French, you want to join us at the table, please? Senate Bill 68 is before us, and if you'd identify yourself for the record and proceed with your sponsor statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Hollis French. I represent West Anchorage in the state Senate. With me today is a staffer, my staffer, Allison Biostock, who has done an enormous amount of work on the bill and is familiar with its details. The idea behind Senate Bill 68 is to respond to the concerns of many of Alaskans who carry auto insurance and yet who are injured by and affected by those who do not. And so the impetus is just that simple. It's to try to reduce the number of uninsured drivers on the roads in Alaska. A national group called the Insurance Research Council estimates that about 14 to 15% of the drivers on Alaska's roads do not carry auto insurance. And yet, when you look at crash data, when you look at the data of the automobile accidents that happen in the state, there's about 18,000 that took place in 2006. 28% of those drivers involved don't carry insurance. So while they make up 14% of the uninsured population, or they make up 14% of the individuals on the road, they're twice as likely to be involved in an accident, which sort of comports with what your common sense might tell you, that you're dealing with a riskier and less responsible population that's causing harm far out of what you might expect from their numbers. What we pay each month, what all of us pay each month, to cover the risk of being injured by an uninsured motorist is about 6% of a full coverage policy, or 14% of just a bare bones liability policy. So that translates to something around the lines of $75 to $80 a year that each Alaskan has to pay as a tax, if you will, to cover the risk of being injured by an uninsured motorist. Currently, there's no real method for enforcing the uninsured motorist provisions, and so the genesis of the bill was to take advantage of modern database capabilities and allow the Division of Motor Vehicles to talk to, if you will, the insurance industry and talk to a database that would inform the Department of Motor Vehicles about the number of uninsured motorists each month. You simply would make a list of all known registered vehicles, compare it to a list of all known insurance policies, and common sense tells you that the list of vehicles is going to be 15% bigger than the list of policies. And then communicate that lack of insurance to the uninsured motorist and warn them that if they don't do something about it in the next 30 days, they're going to lose their car registration. And if nothing happens, then go ahead and revoke the car registration, thus leaving them exposed to greater penalties and a greater likelihood of having the car impounded, if you will, for driving with a revoked registration. So that's a brief overview of the bill, Mr. Chairman. And we have, of course, worked with Department of Motor Vehicles. I think you may hear from Mr. Bennett today. We're very grateful for his attention and his help. Likewise, Linda Hall from the Division of Insurance is here. She's provided some valuable insights into how the insurance market works and some of the statistics that I've quoted to you earlier today. Likewise, we've, of course, talked to the insurance industry. They're keenly interested in this bill. I think you'll hear a variety of suggestions and ideas about how to make the bill better. I'm not wedded to any particular method. My object is to respond to the concerns of my constituents who are frustrated with the number of uninsured motorists on the road and to try to do something to push that number down. And by doing so, reduce our insurance bills, because, you know, in a perfect world, in a world of no uninsured motorists, of course, you wouldn't have to pay a penny for the risk of being injured by an uninsured motorist. And so, you know, economics just dictates that the fewer uninsured drivers, the lower your uninsured motorist bill. So that's an overview of the bill, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator French. We appreciate you being here. Are there comments or questions for the sponsor? If not at this time, if you could just stay with us, we'll have some folks come up to testify. The intent of the chair is just to have the bill before us for initial presentation and discussion, to hold it over for some more work and details, and to bring it back before us at a future hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So thanks for being here. I see we have Dwayne Bannock signed up on the witness sheet, but to answer questions only. Or Mr. Bannock, is that correct? Did you have a presentation, or are you just here to answer questions?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. If you'd like, I can echo some of the comments of Senator French, if you'd like.
Sure, please go ahead.
Good afternoon, sir. I'm Dwayne Bannock with the Division of Motor Vehicles. Also with me today is Carrie Hennings, our Manager of Driver Licensing. First off, Mr. Chairman, thank you for allowing us the opportunity to participate in this bill via the telephone. And to perhaps just follow up on some of the comments by Senator French, it has been our pleasure in working with his office in attempting to create a bill that we all agree on. Our goal is to reduce the number of uninsured motorists that are on the streets today. He shared with you a couple of important numbers, and I'd like to just follow up on them. Out of every crash that was recorded in the state of Alaska last year, 28% of them involved a car that did not have automobile insurance. I believe, like probably the rest of you, that those are not acceptable numbers, and we applaud the senator's efforts in attempting to establish a way that collectively we can work to reduce that number. And with that, sir, that concludes my opening remarks, and if there are any questions, we'd be happy to take them.
Thank you, sir. Senator Bundy has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And at the outset, I certainly want to see fewer uninsured drivers on the road, too. I just have some questions about mechanics and impact. We obviously have a law you require to have a license, and we have a substantial number of people who drive with revoked license. I'm just wondering what your opinion is of the compliance rate, and or if something like this and this automatic reporting could include people who have their license revoked but still have registered cars, that the police could be have those on their hot sheet too.
Senator Bundy, through the chair, if I understand that scenario correctly, you're asking perhaps a percentage of how many owners of vehicles are currently the owner themselves, their driver's license is revoked, yet they still own vehicles?
Mr. Chairman, perhaps I'm asking the question inartfully. What's the compliance rate or what's the violation rate of people who drive with suspended license? Two, is there some way to interface a database that would have the non-insured driver? I assume the police are going to have a list of license plates for someone who's uninsured, and combine that with people who are driving with revoked license.
Senator Bundy, through the chair, if I may try to get some good numbers. I certainly don't have those available at my fingertips, but I believe that I understand the question, and we'll be happy to provide that information.
Thank you very much. We will. This bill, as I said, will be back before us at a future time, so if you can attempt to get that information. Senator Bundy, go ahead.
And one more question about the fiscal note. Obviously, safe highways do have a cost. Well, I thought they did, but we repealed some taxes recently that would indicate that we don't care how much it costs. In any case, or some of us may not care, there is a fiscal impact. You have a fiscal note here, and using the user cost, user pay philosophy, do you plan to increase the driver's license to pay for this, or will that be just an additional request from the general fund?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, we are not necessarily proposing an increase of the cost of a driver's license. I might add that while the Division of Motor Vehicles does show a pretty hefty fiscal note, the fact of the matter is we still, even with this fiscal note, contribute nearly five times as much to the general fund as we take for operating.
And I think that, Mr. Chairman, I might, in the next year or so, that contribution may become even more significant. So, a decrease in your contribution is not something we should look forward to. But, all right, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. The next person on the list is Kenton Brine. Mr. Brine?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is Kenton Brine here today on behalf of the Property Casualty Insurers Association of America, and I, too, appreciate the opportunity to speak with you by telephone today from my office in Olympia, Washington. Listening to the testimony, I first of all would like to say that we insurers and PCI's members represent about 40% of the auto insurance market across the country. We share drivers' frustration and policymakers' frustration about the percentage of drivers who drive without insurance coverage. It might be interesting for you to know that insurers typically are not in favor of mandatory auto liability insurance laws, even though nearly every state, and possibly every state at this point, has one, for the reason that this issue tends to address, which is that they don't have a great deal of effectiveness in deterring people who are determined to drive without insurance. And similarly, when states attempt to enforce laws through different measures, be they impoundment of vehicles, removal of license plates, removal of driver licenses, any of the variety of efforts that that states go through to try and enforce mandatory auto liability insurance laws, what tends to happen is there's a spike in compliance for a period of time, and then the numbers gradually drift back up to where they were previous to that. I've looked at the same Insurance Research Council numbers that were presented to you earlier. I've got no quarrel with what's presented there. I think, though, that what we've seen, what insurers have seen, and I think what the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators would also say, is that the programs, particularly the electronic database programs, have not proven themselves to be highly effective ways of either tracking or changing compliance levels with uninsured motorists. The reason for this varies from state to state. In some cases, we don't actually know if the programs are effective because the methods used to determine the effectiveness are not proven or sound or tested appropriately. So we don't know if the information that the states provide in terms of the effectiveness are accurate. An example I can give you as to the questionable effectiveness is that we saw a bill in Utah last year to change the reporting requirements on insurers from once a month to twice a month. During the debate on that, there was a great deal of discussion from the vendor that was hired by the state to administer the database matching program, a company called InsureRight. And the information the legislators in Utah received was that the uninsured motorist rate in Utah was about 5%, thanks to the efforts of this program. But the Insurance Research Council, which uses a comparison of uninsured motorist claim frequency to bodily injury claim frequency to determine as close as you can come estimate of uninsured motorists, pegs the rate of uninsured drivers in Utah to be about 10%, or about double what InsureRight claimed was their success rate, the uninsured motorist rate in Utah. As I did a quick study across the board at what information I could find about studies that have been done on this, what keeps coming back is that we're not sure if these programs work, and at worst, we're fairly sure that they don't work. In the process of instituting them, there are costs borne by taxpayers in the millions of dollars for these programs in each state where they're enacted. There are costs to consumers, both direct costs if there's a mistake made and you're a driver of an insured vehicle, but for some mistake that's been made, either in the recording of your VIN number or something else in the reporting to the state, you're reported as an uninsured driver. There may be significant hassle for you to get that information corrected, and there may be costs imposed and penalties imposed until you get that all straightened out and turned around. And we find that that might be a risk as well. So the costs involved, I think, are of concern to us, both in terms of the cost to taxpayers and the cost to insureds, if there's a mistake made. And I think that as we look at the broader issue of uninsured motorists, it might be useful to consider what things can be done in the insurance marketplace that makes the product more attractive for people to buy. Again, I'll repeat what I said earlier. There is just frankly going to be a percentage of people. I don't think it has to be 15 or 16%. Maybe it can be 5 or 8 or 7 or 4 or something like that percent that are not going to buy liability insurance coverage. And the reason for that varies from person to person, but it might involve something as simple as the basic idea that when you buy liability coverage, you're not buying you're buying coverage to protect your assets in the event that you harm someone else on the roads. And there are people who may feel that they don't have adequate assets to protect, and that they're buying an insurance product to cover a vehicle that doesn't have as great a value as the cost of the insurance policy that they're buying to protect someone else, basically. So there is always going to be a percentage of drivers who, for financial reasons or for just other sort of libertarians type reasons, you might say, feel that they shouldn't have to buy insurance coverage and won't do it. However, for the rest of the population who do want to obey the mandate, obey the law, and be responsible drivers, I think it's incumbent upon policymakers and insurers to work together to find ways to keep insurance as affordable as possible. And in that light, some states have considered whether or not to create a separate policy with lower minimum limits. That involves a lengthy and detailed discussion about what can be contained in the policy and whether the state has any mandates about what's covered and not covered and that sort of thing. But it's certainly a discussion that can be had. other cost drivers in the system. Litigation costs, for example, could be examined. And also, I think you'll hear this again today if there are other insurers coming to the table, but there might be interest in speeding the process of getting insurance in people's hands by speeding the rate quote process, which could include something like access to a web-based database of driver records for insurance companies, because currently Alaska is one of only four states in the country that does not allow insurers to look at driver records in an online, real-time, web-based format. So I think there are things that can be done to address system costs. I can tell you that in the state of California, where they have a very high rate of uninsured drivers, the voters took matters into their own hands and passed an initiative that said if you are an uninsured motorist and you're involved in an accident that isn't your fault, you are not entitled to collect non-economic damages as a result of that accident. So you might still be entitled to collect for your actual injuries and wage loss and that sort of thing, but you're not entitled to specials and non-economic damages. So there are other approaches to take as far as enforcement goes as well. We'd be pleased to work with the committee and to provide any information that any of the members would like to have about experiences across the country with these programs, tell you in greater detail what our concerns are. But for today, I would just want to go on record as being opposed to Section 5 of this legislation and offer our assistance if we can find other ways to reduce costs and encourage more motorists to obtain insurance.
Thank you, Mr. Bryan. We appreciate you being with us. Are there questions or comments? Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under Alaska's current system, we have uninsured driver's insurance, and does that, in at least in theory and hopeful reality, protect me if I'm in an accident with an uninsured person from at least property damage?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, yes, under uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage, I believe, are both available in Alaska. I'm not certain that they are combined coverages or if they're offered separately. And I would say that one of the suggestions I came across in some of the research I've done is that, you know, you get to a point where you want to compare, which program is more effective. A motorist who chooses to spend a few dollars, and I don't think that UIM policies are particularly expensive, added on to the cost of your liability policy. And hopefully we might be able to hear from an insurance agent who knows a lot more about this than I do, but you might weigh the cost of carrying an uninsured motorist policy versus the cost to you as a taxpayer and you as a policyholder of administering a program that grows in size, complexity, and cost over time. That may or may not have any effectiveness on your chances of getting hit by an uninsured driver.
If I might continue. It leads me to my next question, and I think if I understood Senator French's introduction correctly, that the people who are uninsured are involved in a disproportionate number of accidents, which would lead me to think they're a higher risk pool, and of course, that makes me wonder what that would do to my rates, that you're having people of higher risk in the same insurance pool. I mean, even though you have increased numbers, then you have increased numbers of higher risk people. And maybe this is a question for an insurance agent. Then would you envision that someone who was caught driving without insurance would then have to go into a higher risk pool so as not to disadvantage the rest of us?
Senator Bundy, through the chair again, I believe that in general, I'm going to speak in general terms. If there is someone there who has direct experience with riding coverage, I'd invite them to go into further detail. But, you know, in general, the idea of insurance is to pool risks, similar risks together, so that the higher risks are paying a rate that's similar to each other, and not pooling higher risk people in with the lowest risk people in order to balance out the cost. That's not typically how insurance works. And it certainly isn't the way we want insurance to work. Would it be more costly for a person who had no insurance or who had lost their insurance for reasons involving too many accidents or that sort of thing? Would they have to pay more for coverage? Certainly. Uh, w- Would they be pooled in with lower risk people? No, not likely. They would be pooled in with other people of a similar risk who are also paying more for their insurance coverage. That, however, does not necessarily mean that the coverage becomes impossibly unaffordable for people, or that the legislature might not be able to explore things related to what can be mandated within for coverage within those policies to make those policies more affordable for people. That's certainly open to public policy debate.
Thank you. If I might, Mr. Chairman,
go right ahead.
Taxing your patience, I'm sure. And perhaps you're the person to ask, if not who you might recommend that I ask of. One of my frustrations as I thought about these issues is that someone who buys insurance and then cancels it the next month or something like that. So I understand this bill, it would be monthly reporting. You said in Utah they even had to go to twice a month reporting. And again, computers are very useful in this, but there has to be some financial impact of that, and I'm just wondering what impact that would have on rates.
Thank you for your question, Senator. Through the chair, I am currently asking PCI, my organization, to do some kind of informal poll of our members to find out if there's an average cost. I can tell you that when this bill went through in Utah, it kind of went through quickly. They have a short session there. Things happen fast. And quite frankly, we got caught a little flat-footed, and the bill had already moved out. Having gone through an interim process, and we never really had the chance to debate that and investigate what those costs were. But I can tell you that the response I got from insurance company members of the PCI was that these are costly programs to administer. They're not easily shifted. They're computer-based, and there's a lot of reformatting that has to be done when there's a change made to them, and the initiation of them is also costly as well. I think I want to add, though, that you've made an important point that I think I intended to make earlier. This, let's call it gaming the system, is something that's very real. And whether reporting is done on a twice monthly or once monthly or even less often basis, there is going to be opportunity for people who are determined to do so to fake it, to either get some proof of insurance that isn't real or purchase insurance, hold it long enough to have the reporting go through and cancel it. I think people who are determined to avoid the law are more sophisticated than we might give them credit for. And they're one of the reasons why, in general, I think this the electronic database program is questionable in its effectiveness is because we don't know how much of that could occur, and we don't know how accurate the database will be from month to month. So it's definitely a concern of ours as well.
Thank you, Mr. Bryant. And Senator Bundy, we will have more opportunity on this bill as well in the future. So we don't have to do it all today. And I want to get to all the witnesses. And Mr. Steve Fleischer, are you online, Mr. Fleischer?
Can you hear me now?
You just came on. Could you state your name again and your affiliation for the record? Please go ahead and take about 3 minutes or so, and we will have the bill before us again if you don't get through all of your material.
Thank you very much. Hello, Chairman Ellis, Mr. French, and other senators and committee members. I want to thank you in advance for this opportunity to speak to you on Senate Bill 68. My name is Steve Flasher. I am an insurance agent in Anchorage, and I have been in the business here for 37 years. On the surface, this bill sounds really great, but I do have several concerns that I would like to present to you. First of all is private customer information that we will be sending to an online vendor, and at that point, what kind of security would be in place to make sure that this information is protected? Will this vendor be able to sell this information to other insurance companies or use it for their own use? Another real problem, as our previous speaker stated, depending upon how fast this information is updated, is the correctness of information that is sent to the vendor. Where you would have a problem with this is if a name is misspelled for some reason. In other words, if it was Stephen with a V or Stephen with a P on a registration versus what they gave us when they came in to start an insurance policy. And a real big problem with information is VIN numbers. You have a 17-digit number for every car. We oftentimes input that wrong because the customer gave it to us wrong, and we have to deal with credit unions and banks all the time to correct this information. So there could be a real concern there. Another problem that I see would be if a customer came in and made a payment today on a canceled policy, and we reported to the vendor that that policy is canceled, he was reinstated, and then you don't get another update for 2 weeks or a month, and he gets pulled over and gets his car confiscated, that customer is going to be coming back knocking on my desk saying, why didn't I report that to that agency as soon as possible? If a person made a payment in my office today and left our office, he is insured. And if he had an accident, he would be covered. But according to that reporting agency, he doesn't have a policy. So there's some real issues with the timeliness of reporting. The third point I want to bring out is the cost of this program. Ultimately, it's going to be passed on to the consumer and to the insurance companies, and they will raise the rates of their current carriers to pay for this. I really don't feel that this program is going to offset the number of uninsured drivers. The real reason we have such a high number of uninsured drivers is basically cost of insurance. And all this does is add to that cost of insurance. My last point, which was also brought up by the previous speaker, is that we're just adding another layer of bureaucracy when we do not have interactive MVRs in our state. Currently in my office, it takes 2 to 3 days for us to obtain a customer's MVR information, and that slows down the whole process of being able to accurately quote and put policies in force. So those are a few of my concerns on this. As this goes on, I would like to stay in touch and possibly speak again. I appreciate your time, and if you have any questions, I will take them right now.
Mr. Flasher, thank you for being with us. Are there questions or comments for the witness? If not, thank you for being with us. Is there anyone else here in, like I said, we're going to have this bill before us at a later time. Is there anyone here today who needs to testify today who won't, not likely to be with us? Senator French, did you want to make any comments in response to what we've heard today, or wait till next time?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just say that we continue to work with both the insurance industry and the Department of Motor Vehicles to try to bring the cost of the program down and make it most effective. That's obviously the goal, and so we'll be back to you when we've gotten some of those changes written down on a piece of paper.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for presenting the bill today. We will hold it over at this time. We'll continue the public hearing. We won't just bring it up under bills previously heard. It will be noticed by name and number in the committee announcements. So thank you, Senator French. We'll set this bill aside and go back to the bill that was previously before us, Senate Bill 59. The hearing on Senate Bill 59 has been closed, and we're at the point of committee discussion on the bill. I know of no suggestions or amendments. Nothing's been submitted. I guess there's no markup to do, but is there any committee discussion about the legislation? Maybe for that, the chair will entertain a motion to move the bill on to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move it on the next committee referral, individual recommendations, and there is no attached. The attached fiscal note.
Accompanying fiscal note.
Yeah.
Okay, is there discussion of the motion? Senator Bundy.
Mr. Chairman, I choose to support this initiative, this bill, but just wanted to make a comment, if I might. As we heard, I think, repeatedly in testimony at length, that radio advertising will make the nonprofits who do have their gaming/gambling permits more productive. They will be able to generate more funds for their various charities. Goes without saying, the people that handle those charities will make more money too. But it's all right, we're a capitalist society. I view this bill as probably something, or the current prohibition is something left over from perhaps Alaska's blue law days, where it just isn't in sync with modern reality. One of the main reasons I will be supporting the legislation is that in my mind it is indeed an expansion of gambling, in that it, because of advertising, radio advertising is effective. More people will take place, will take part in these various currently allowed lotteries and other gaming opportunities. And I think Alaska's missing a bet. Alaskans are a gambling group, and this living here can be a gamble sometimes. And I think it's meeting a need that we should even explore further. So this is a small step in that direction, and I plan to support it.
Okay. Further discussion of the on the motion to move the bill? Bill goes on to the Rules Committee. Seeing no further discussion, seeing no objection to the motion, the bill moves on to the Rules Committee. Thank you, Senator Stevens. Is there any further business to come before us? I know I have an announcement of next week's agenda. On Tuesday of next week, we begin some important overviews, and I hope we will have as many folks here as can be here. Tuesday the 13th will be rural economic development, some very interesting comments about that, some ideas for the committee, and then also workforce development in the healthcare and medical industries. Then on Tuesday the 15th, we'll continue some overviews on workforce development, especially in the construction trades and getting ready for a future gas pipeline. So some important things that I hope will lead to some, maybe some budget items or possibly some legislation from the committee, if so warranted. So please be with us for the overviews next week. Is there any further business to come before the committee? If not, thank you all for your attendance today. We are adjourned at 2:30 in the afternoon.